Welcome to the Psych Podcast, a podcast where we discuss everything intro psych with my friend, my colleague, Paul Bloom. Welcome, Paul.
Good to talk to you again, David.
Today, we are talking about a difficult topic, Paul, one that is near and dear to my heart.
Important, urgent, stressful.
It's a topic that you, Paul, could have not included in your book and nobody would have said anything.
I think that's right. It was a conscious decision to put into my book. There's a couple of aspects of it, but the primary aspect that we'll talk about isn't even about psychology. It's about a lot of contemporary science in general. But I do think it's important, and I do think it's kind of an elephant in the room where I could have skipped it, but then people would say, well, you made a choice skipping it, and maybe it was an irresponsible choice.
So what we're referring to is what has been dubbed the replication crisis in psychology, but as you point out, in other fields as well. And I guess simply put, it is the growing realization, the sort of quick onset realization within psychology, especially in some fields of psychology, that many of the studies that we thought were contributing to the scientific body of literature actually can't be repeated. They can't be replicated. So a paper, for instance, gets published once, and 10 years later, people try to do the same experiments that were presented in that paper, but over and over again, people have an inability to replicate the basic result.
That's exactly it. So there's sort of two ways to approach the crisis. One is what you're talking about, which is a lot of the findings that people who are listening to us now say, oh, that's a finding from psychology, I heard that, don't seem to replicate. And it doesn't seem to replicate because it wasn't true. And so that's one part of it, that observation. There was a study in Science that found that about 40% of studies are successfully replicated when you try to replicate them. And that's part of it. And then the other part is people have realized why they failed to replicate. And the answer is that the original studies were done in such a way that they artificially inflate the chances of getting a positive result. And we could talk about the different ways in which they do that. One simple thing is publication bias. If you make a practice of only publishing studies that work, you kind of skew things to give a feeling that more things work than what they don't. There's something which comes under different names. P-hacking is a standard name. One statistician, Andrew Gelman, calls it the garden of forking paths, which as a Borges fan, you should appreciate.
Absolutely.
Do you want to give a shot in describing what p-hacking is?
Sure. P-hacking is the practice of using various tactics or techniques that lead you to find and focus on positive results, even though they're embedded in a whole host of negative results. If you run 20 analyses, say statistical analyses, chances are you might find one that gives you a significant result purely by chance. And researchers were often inclined to search until they found that one analysis, whether that was by splitting their data set, looking at certain questions and not other questions. There are a lot of decisions that can be made along the way, what people have referred to as researcher degrees of freedom. That is, you can decide which observations should be included in your data set and which shouldn't. You can decide whether to look at your analyses, dividing it up by male and female or by age brackets. And once you start engaging in all of those steps, you're gonna see statistically significant results emerge. That's always going to happen so long as you do enough of that, even when there's absolutely nothing in the data.
That's a great summary. I mean, the issue, one way to think about it, is like drawing the bullseye after you fired the arrow.
That's a much more efficient way of describing
it. No, but I mean, going through it, it's worthwhile. I mean, I tell a sort of parable in my book about you discover that people who work in pink rooms do more creative work than people who do work in white rooms. And you say, wow, that's a great finding. And it's true, it would be an amazing finding if you found it a practical value, theoretical value. But then suppose you found out that, and I'll tell it slightly different from my book, you found out that the experimenters had like 20 conditions with all these different colors. And then they broke them up into men and women and different ages. And then it didn't work. And then they tried it again. And then they tried it again. And finally, they found out that people who work in pink rooms are more creative. Well, that's going to happen by chance. It's an even simpler example is I say, I'm amazing. I could do three heads in a row. You say, well, that's really impressive. And then I keep flipping my coin until I get three heads in a row. I said, there, I got it. Well, that's not impressive at all.
And even more distressing is that you could flip a coin 100 times and videotape that, and you get 3 in a row. And what you do is edit your video. So you cut out everything but that little streak. And then you upload that to YouTube and say, look at this amazing talent of Paul Bloom to hit 3 heads in a row. It's not that you didn't hit 3 heads in a row, right? It is absolutely the case that there is this observation that there were 3 heads in a row. What it means, though, is on its own, that can't be evidence of anything because you have failed to report that you did it 100 times and you got 50 heads and 50 tails. And what you're showing is that chance is uneven. People sometimes say chance is lumpy. The distribution of results clumps. So you can selectively draw circles around various results. And if you only report that, it seems like you have very powerful evidence.
And one thing to emphasize in all of this is, I mean, the way we're talking, we sort of we have an image of psychologists rubbing their hands together and saying, how are we going to cleverly go through the data and figure out some results so we can get things published, knowing that this is, you know, a bad practice. But for the longest time, maybe people thought there was something a little bit wrong about this. I quote some critics who say people used to think it's wrong, like it's wrong to jaywalk. And now we're discovering it's wrong, like it's wrong to rob a bank. But back in the day, and I was as guilty of this as anybody else, it was kind of what you expected to do. You do a big study, you look at the data, you're with your students, you're with your collaborators, you look at the data and you say, well, what worked? What effects did we get?
Yeah.
Okay, there's no overall effect, but gee, if you just look at the, you know, developmental, say you look at the 10-year-olds, there's something really interesting going on here. And it's like you're looking at the data, discovering findings. And then later on when you write the paper, things kind of transform a bit in your mind and you kind of get the feeling you predicted those weird effects you found. And at no point did you say, I'm going to publish something which probably isn't true. You really believe this stuff. But if we fail to take into account the fact that always looking at the data in multiple ways increases our odds of a false positive finding, we're going to get ourselves in all sorts of trouble. And we got ourselves in all sorts of trouble.
We certainly did. And yes, I think it's absolutely important to distinguish malice, malicious intent from just error. And I will say, like, I was trained in a very specific way to do that, to look for results. There's a naive, I'm saying naive belief here, by which I mean, even I had it, that when you collect data and you have a data set, that there are results in there, that there are findings in that data set that have to be uncovered.
Yeah.
And that what running statistical tests on all of the data is doing is, well, there might be a needle in this haystack. Let me find it. So that when you finally get a significant statistical result, you say, aha, that's where it was.
That's right.
And I think there is this sense that, well, how could it have given me a significant finding if that weren't true? And what's really being missed is how statistics work and how chance works.
I think that's exactly right.
If you run enough tests, you're going to get something by chance.
That's right. And I think we should be careful here, since with the exception of ourselves, I don't want to point to anybody and present them as bad examples. I think one thing we talk about is, I think there's a little bit too much public shaming about failure to replicate in someone, which has some bad consequences. But as an example, without giving a name, there's a colleague of yours, not within the psychology department, who put up on some sort of social media parable. And the story was he had some data, and then one student looked at it and gave it a cursory look and says, well, our experiment didn't work. And the second student looked at it really hard and did more analyses and says, no, If you look at this and look at this, we have a really cool finding. And as he told a parable, the second student was the hero. The first student was the layabout, the lazy person, the person who didn't try hard enough. And then it turns out a lot of people said, that's exactly wrong. The second student is doing something which is bound to get you results that are not real.
I can't emphasize enough that this is the way in which many of us were trained, myself included. And while I can be blamed for not taking steps to be less ignorant about statistics, it wasn't anything that I thought was wrong.
Same.
So we have a body of work that for good reason, people are now going back to and trying to see if we are a bit more strict in our procedures, will we still get this result?
That's right. And so there's been a lot of reform. And sometimes the replication crisis is talked about in the context of social psychology. And for a couple of reasons, there's some evidence that there's more replication failures in social psychology than some other fields. But also, and I think more to the credit of this field, social psychologists have been upfront in identifying the problem and developing measures to address it. So one measure is pre-registration. This is sort of equivalent like calling your shots in pool, or an equivalent of actually drawing the bullseye before you shoot the arrow, where you say ahead of time, we expect this finding. This is what our theory predicts. That doesn't preclude you from looking at other things as long as you're honest about it. But it says, this is our main finding. And putting that publicly so that reviewers could see this before you run the experiment. And the logic here, which I think is basically right, I think there's been a controversy, but I think basically right, that by doing so, you discipline yourself to not PHAC. And so if you find the finding you're looking for, people could be confident that this is a real, more or less a real effect, and not the result of you looking through 100 possible effects and then choosing the one that worked at random.
One of the things that has made this possible is the existence of websites like Open Science or aspredicted.org, where you can publicly issue a prediction.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk a little bit more about social psychology. As you say, a lot of the reform came from social psychology, and a lot of the failures to replicate have come from social psychology. So that's concerning. It's also the case, though, that a lot of the social psychology that has been done in the last 20, 30 years is work that's a lot easier to do, in the sense that collecting data presents less of a challenge, in the sense that it's often easier to collect data in social psychology because we're not dealing with babies or clinical populations or non-human primates. We can go and use a service like Amazon's Mechanical Turk and run a quick study and have the results in an afternoon. So it makes sense that social psychology might discover it first.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are certain problems, reasons for the replication failures in social psychology that wouldn't arise in other fields, which is, I'm going to run this by you. You tell me if you think that this is right. But a lot of social psychology hypotheses, for one thing, there's a strong desire to have sexy findings, really cool, paradoxical findings.
Sexy here has nothing to do with sex, but rather just the appeal of a finding, the excitingness of
a finding.
That's
right. So if you do a study on moral blame, and you find that we tend to be more angry at people who commit murder than people who can do shoplifting, that's not very interesting. That's not going to get published in Science or Nature because it kind of makes sense. On the other hand, if you find, I'll make up something, that you're more likely to blame somebody if they're wearing the color red than the color blue, or more likely to blame somebody if you just took a hot shower than a cold shower, well, that's really interesting. You wouldn't have predicted that. And that's the kind of thing that gets in the top journals and gets on TV, gets
press coverage.
And there's also a political aspect to it, where sometimes a lot of social psychologists have kind of political agendas, and this tilts the kind of finding that you want to get. So just as one example, a lot of people discuss, it's a lot kind of easier to publish a paper that finds bias of some sort, racial bias, sexist bias, and so on, than one that doesn't. That also kind of skews the field in ways that may lead to some problems.
And chances are, in the field of visual perception, you're not likely to encounter that kind of resistance to a finding if it doesn't meet somebody's ideology.
That's right. And you might also say that other fields are so boring anyway that you know, there's not that problem.
As you say in your chapter, I mean, there's a reason that social psychology is interesting to people, because it deals with a lot of the problems that we face in our everyday lives, in our public and political lives, as a nation, as a society, as a group of humans on the earth. Social psychology addresses some of the most complex and important problems that there are, which leads me to another reason why social psychology findings might have a harder time replicating. And that is that we're often studying something that has a level of complexity that some of the, for lack of a better term, the lower level areas of psychology don't have, where if I want to understand why people vote conservative or liberal, there are so many things in the world that would influence that. things like where you grew up, who you married, what your income level is, maybe something genetic, something about your personality. There's a ton of things that might influence that. And so finding anything that's reliable, that's going to hold up across a bunch of studies, I think can be tricky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe trickier than a study on a visual illusion or a study on memory.
And it may be tricky for reasons that you might have studies that fail to replicate due to no fault of the experimenter, but because the world has changed in certain ways. So you know, I would think, assume the basic properties of, say, color vision or short-term memory are as true for us as they're true for hunter-gatherers. I mean, it's interesting. There may, in fact, be some cultural effects and so on. But for the most part, you could say this is studies of things that are universal. There's some classic studies, for instance, finding about when you get people to think about old people, you find their behavior changes in certain ways, consistent with how they think about old people. And some of these studies, like a decade later, don't give you the same results. And you could say, oh my gosh, those first studies were poorly done. And, you know, maybe. But it's also possible that our stereotypes of old people have changed. And so the fundamental architecture of how we form stereotypes, how we think about them, could be the same across all humans, but the specifics change. Any study that asks you what you think of about, say, the American political parties, Democrat and Republican, if you tested, if you do a study in 1940 versus 1960 versus 1980, so it's going to yield very different results because the world has changed.
That's right. They're going to be what you might call historical effects, which is what you're talking about. For instance, we've documented, because we have data now that spans 15 years or so, we've documented that bias against homosexuality has gone down over time. Because we have continuous data over all those 15 years, we can see that that happened. If you ran it in 1998 and you ran it now and you got a difference, you might think, well, the researchers just did a bad job that first time around. But that's not the case.
That's exactly right. And so there's all sorts of reasons. I think the replication crisis is real, but we're talking about reasons why a failure to replicate doesn't necessarily show the original finding didn't exist. We also got to account for the fact that sometimes replications are poorly done. I mean, we're presenting this as if this is just yet another topic, but I think we'd be missing something if we didn't talk a little bit about how emotional this issue is for many people. Careers have been destroyed by accusations of shoddy science. And I think if you asked 100 psychologists, you get 100 different opinions over, you know, these people, they should have their careers destroyed, or no, there's a bunch of bullies and people being savagely unfair. And this has really upset the field in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a bit difficult to talk about it without keeping in mind the various people who might listen to us talk about it and have very different opinions because of the experience that they've have had with this sort of sweeping set of reforms and the accusations of shoddy science and all that. It's as much a sociological phenomenon as it is one of scientific progress. Maybe I can talk a little bit about the experience that I had watching this whole thing unfold. It started for me with a colleague of mine at Cornell who, pretty soon after I arrived at Cornell, published a paper showing some small but, he claimed, reliable effects that extrasensory perception was real.
Oh, yes.
So this is Daryl Bem. This is not a secret, and I'm not speaking ill of him. He published the paper. He believed it. He made all of his materials and data publicly available. He wasn't trying to hide anything. I remember being faced with this real dilemma. I did not believe that this was true. I, in fact, firmly believed that a social psychologist couldn't upend the laws of space and time by showing that 53% of the time some people could predict the future better than chance. I remember thinking to myself, well, this is a weird dilemma to be in, because as a field, we have sort of agreed on a set of statistical tests, methodological procedures that count as legitimate. And here, Daryl Bem has shown, using those very methods, that there is a result that I have so much reason to believe is not true. I'm not sure what to do about this paper. And sure enough, many people count that as sort of
patient zero.
Patient zero, exactly, of the replication crisis.
I remember that was published in, I think, the top journal of social psychology, JPSP, Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And I remember a lot of people were furious and thought the journal should not have published it.
Yeah, I personally thought that it shouldn't have been published as well. I thought that there was so much more reason to believe in the laws of space and time that would go against it. But I have very, very smart colleagues who disagree with me. And now looking back, it may be that this was an important thing to publish because of the result that it had.
There's a point made by the philosopher David Hume and others, which is the extent to which you believe a claim depends on sort of your what sort of prior beliefs it would shake up. So with regard to miracles, you know, if I would trust you. So if you said you had orange juice for breakfast today, I'd say, well, okay, sure. But if you told me you have the ability to levitate and you were flying around your apartment, your house yesterday, I would say, well, I normally trust you, but that's so outlandish. I have to say you're lying or you've gone crazy. It's much more likely to me that you're lying or gone crazy than you've acquired the powers of flight. It's much more likely that something went wrong in Daryl Bem's study of some sort, then people can tell the future. But now having said that, you now have to, in some way, the reason why this was patient's error is of course to say, well, his analyses and his methods were no different than any other paper published in this prestigious journal. So if you don't trust them, now you have to question those analyses and those methods.
And that's the only conclusion that I could come to. Luckily, there were smarter psychologists than me who published a paper entitled cleverly False Positive Psychology, sort of a play on positive psychology, showing exactly how they could manipulate data, manipulate analyses in order to find something that could not be true.
Yeah. Right?
So showing, for instance, that an experimental manipulation of listening to one song versus another caused the average age of a participant to decrease.
The song was When I'm 64.
I forgot.
And I think the finding was listening to that made you older.
Made you actually old.
And then they said, since, you know, well, you're probably not going to believe that. So now you have to question, you know, how we got that conclusion.
That's right. What they demonstrated systematically was what we were discussing before, that whenever you have the ability to make certain choices in your analyses, carve up the data in ways that you may not have said you were going to, all fairly innocuous steps, you can actually arrive at a conclusion that statistically seems robust, but that cannot in fact be true.
And when this happened, we keep saying this, it shook up the field tremendously and continues to. So this morning, I'm on Twitter and somebody publishes this analysis and this set of replications saying that yet another well-known psychological phenomena apparently doesn't replicate, apparently is not real. And I don't know if I believe it or not. I think sometimes people are too quick to reject these, but it's reached a point where when we're writing a book on psychology or lecturing to intro psych students, we have to sort of ask for just about everything. Okay, does this hold up? How much can we trust this?
Yeah, that leads me to a question that I wanted to ask you, which is, has this so-called replication crisis changed the way that you teach? I have found that I'm sort of forced to make some judgment calls about what to talk about in an introduction to psychology class. It's even my concern now, Paul, that we have gone too deep into the weeds for our audience. How much should our students know about this?
So I think there's two ways to take your question. One way in which I think for both of us, the crisis has changed how we teach is that, I'll put it in my terms, I used to talk about some studies and say, this is going to seem unbelievable to you, but it's true. And then I talk about the study. And now for some of those specific studies, I no longer do that because, in fact, it probably isn't true. This, you know, and so a lot of my psychology class has gotten smaller in some ways, where a lot of experiments just I don't talk about because I don't believe them anymore. So that's one way which I think has affected us. The second question, which is harder, is when you're teaching intro psych, how much do you go into the weeds of as we're doing now? And I tend to want to teach the students about what we know about the mind. And since there's just so many hours we have, I spend less time on debates within the field of where we've gone wrong and how our practices could be improved. Not because, I mean, it's interesting enough for us to talk about it here. I just think I'd rather be telling students, here's what we know about memory. Here's what we know about sexual desire. Here's what we know about schizophrenia, rather than focusing too much on the meta science of how we know it and maybe how we got it wrong in the past.
We want to communicate true things to our students. And in part, I take it as my responsibility to distinguish true from false. And so the replication crisis has affected me in as much as I have shifted my standards for what counts as evidence and what doesn't. And so now I may talk about different studies than I used to talk about. Just like you, I've discarded discussion of some studies entirely because I've lost faith in whether they're true or not. But that doesn't mean that I have to jump into a discussion of replication any more than I would have to jump into a discussion of particular statistical techniques that are used in the field.
That's right. That's right. I don't talk about statistics either in the field or experimental design very much, only the amount they need to know to follow the studies. There are people we both know who would say, look, this matters a lot more than we're talking about. The replication crisis shows that scientific psychology has been built on a house of sand. And I think you and I, and since we're this far into this discussion, it's pretty clear that we don't believe that. And I think each of us could list several dozens of established findings and interesting theories and real discoveries from our field that have stood the test of time, that have survived a replication crisis. And that's kind of what I want to focus on in my course.
There is a bit of schadenfreude, I think, sometimes when people hear about psychology not working or not being reliable, because I think that there are a lot of people who doubt whether or not psychology can be a real science for less well thought out reasons. Maybe they think that there is something special about humans that we don't lend ourselves nicely to scientific investigation, maybe because they hold dualistic beliefs. They believe that human behavior can't be treated as caused in the same way that weather can or the motion of billiard balls can. A lot of reasons why people might suspect psychology. But I firmly believe that the human mind is a product of natural causes. And to the extent that we can study natural causes and effects, we can build a science of psychology. And I think we have plenty of evidence that is the case. It's just harder. Yeah, it's just way more right. complicated than a lot of things that we study. The weather doesn't even begin to offer a proper comparison to the complexity of the human mind, but it's a good one to point to every once in a while when people want some higher level of prediction than they're getting from psychology.
That's right. And I think when people focus a lot on the sort of sexier claims, it's sexier in the sense of intuitively interesting and wow, I couldn't believe that, falling apart. I think that that's true, but we shouldn't lose track of the real foundational discoveries we've made. So just to take one example of many and many and many, one of the interesting findings of psychology is how our memories of the past can be distorted by the questions we're asked, can be distorted by our expectations and belief. And that's rock solid. And we could list hundreds of other ones. We could also list cases where there's interesting theoretical debate where you just don't know the answer to them, but the data is clear enough.
Yeah. I like to talk a little bit about replication when I talk about psychology as a science. One reason that I do mention it is that I think that it has become enough of a topic of discussion for an educated general audience that I feel the need to say something about it to preempt questions or other concerns that students might have if I didn't bring it up. But one of the things I really want my students to have by the end of the course is some ability to distinguish good from bad when it comes to psychological studies. But one clear rule of thumb that I think everybody should have for all sciences is that no single study really ever offers enough evidence to convince you of anything. There, for so many reasons, you can doubt the results of a single study. But to go to the example that you gave, that memories can be distorted, that has been established by hundreds and hundreds of studies,
That's right. I think that's an excellent rule of thumb, which is when you read in the newspaper or online or something like that, scientists discover that, you know, taller men like the color purple or whatever. Just say, okay, you know, I'm not going to change my worldview on this. Wait until there's 10, 100, 1,000 studies supporting it. And then I could believe it. Just a single study almost never provides enough information to change your what they call your priors, your expectations about the world.
And when you have a single study, say, showing something that seems kind of crazy, it's also important to remember that a single study failing to replicate that is also one study.
That's right.
Just because it came after doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. Of course, a lot of times there is some care to collect more data than the original study or to fix some problems, but it's not always the case. So what you might have when you have one study that fails to get replicated is two studies, one that worked and one that didn't.
That's right.
And you have to do a little bit of work to figure out which one might be true. And I think the best course of action is to wait until other people jump in and try to do it as well.
Yeah, the order shouldn't matter.
Right.
You know, if you'd respond differently, if the one that worked came second rather than first, you're thinking of it the wrong way. There's just two studies. Throw them in the mix and see how things work out. You know, I don't talk about replication in my course, but maybe I should. I think you're making kind of a case for it. Another reason to talk about it is it nicely illustrates some aspects of this, of how science in general and psychology in particular is a human endeavor. It's not done by gods. It's not done in some sort of abstract way. A lot of the reason for the problems of psychology are because psychologists, they're ambitious. They have personal ambitions. They want to get well known. They want to get tenure. They want to get jobs. They want to get into graduate school. They want to get positions. And there's tremendous pressure to make an impact. And this isn't just, of course, not just psychology. It's everything. And it's certainly every science. And so the replication crisis and how we responded to it is a good illustration of how a sort of society can check reasonable, normal human impulses that distort the science.
And I firmly believe that most sciences suffer from these problems in a way that will emerge. Who knows how replicable, I don't know, biology is. I don't know.
Well, Nature did this. I don't remember the numbers offhand, but did a review where it's got cancer research, and an extraordinary number of studies in that field don't replicate because there's various incentives there, including a lot of financial ones to talk about your studies and make them work.
That's right. You talked about publication bias a little bit in the beginning of this conversation, and I think sometimes of the field of nutrition.
Oh, God, yes.
Not to diss nutrition, but false positive findings pop up there all the time. So imagine if you ask 1,000 people all of the things that they eat every day, and then you get them to list all of the various diseases or maladies that they've had. And you toss it all into one big statistical analysis, and you find that, you know, people who eat broccoli sleep better.
Yeah.
That might get published, and you might even get a headline, "Eat your broccoli, you'll sleep better." And that is insane making. It sure drives me insane to see something like that, because for one, it conflates correlation and causation. We don't know what the direction of causality might be there. But even more importantly, it might not be a finding at all, because again, if you've done 100 analyses, you're going to find a handful of them that are significant. And if you had no way of distinguishing beforehand which ones you thought were going to come out, then you're simply drawing circles again around targets.
That's true. I mean, one way, I'm not the first to put it this way, but if you did a huge study on broccoli eaters versus non-broccoli eaters and found no difference, and then you said, well, let's look at it in terms of astrological signs. Let's first look at the Sagittarius and the Leo and the Capricorns. You wouldn't be surprised if you found, you know, oh my God, Pisces, you get an effect. And then you could publish, you know, if you're Pisces, eat broccoli.
That's right.
Of course, if you ask the question enough times, by chance, you'll get the answer.
That's right. This episode of Psych is sponsored by GiveWell. When you give to charity, how much impact will your donation actually have? This question can be hard, if not impossible, to answer. Most charities just can't tell you how your money will be used or how much good it'll accomplish. You may know it could theoretically help a cause, but how? Or more importantly, how much? If you want to help people living in poverty with evidence-backed, high-impact charities, we recommend you check out GiveWell. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funds to a few of the highest impact evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and will improve the lives of millions more. Using GiveWell's research is absolutely free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There's no need to sign up, no need to give any personal information. They want you to have it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Make sure that they know you heard about GiveWell from psych to get your donation matched. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of psych.
So we're talking throughout, and in every case we're talking about well-intentioned people kind of doing their best, but being either ignorant of what they're doing or sometimes being motivated by certain very reasonable motivations. And then there's the question, which we just got to talk about it, however briefly, of total fraud, where people making up their data. And I'm curious what you think the proportion is. So we know it's not zero. There has been famous cases. There's one famous case in social psychology of someone who got caught doing many studies, well-known studies, and just literally making up the data. And psychologists always ask each other this, so I'm curious what you think. How frequent do you think that is?
Perhaps I'm a bit naive here. The example that you're referring to of Dietrich Stoppel, who made up dozens of entire papers with purely fabricated data, I think I would put money on that. That's very rare. If only because you're entering a level of risky behavior that is, I don't know, yeah. I think that the chances of getting caught doing that might be pretty high. What concerns me are the little ways in which people might lie. And I would still classify it as fraud, right? I'm not talking about innocent mistakes or naive mistakes of method or statistics, but rather somebody who realizes that, well, if I exclude these three in this condition, my numbers all of a sudden look just like I predicted them. And so they'll remove them. Even worse, maybe add some numbers. Then I think you're getting into some more common territory, but I'd still think it's single-digit percentages.
That's right. There's Stoppel was an extraordinarily blatant fraud. Once people noticed it was very, very clear what had happened. But then there's the question, which is every scientist in our field has a period where they're looking at the Excel data sheet with all the numbers there and everything and doing analyses. And you're right, which at any point one of us could say, well, it's almost working. If I switch this number from a 5 to a 6, all of a sudden it would work and there's not a soul in the world that would know I did it. And I'd like to think that there's enough moral and cultural forces saying that is forbidden. You must not do that. That very few people do it. My sense also is, and this I don't have any data on, is that when somebody does it, they'll do it again and again. This sounds like some sort of, I don't know, Martin Scorsese film or something, but they've fallen or the plot of Breaking Bad. But once you do a little sin like that, the rest of the sins come easy.
Right. It's like a mob movie where the first time a guy has to whack somebody, they throw up. But then, you know, the next time it's easier. And the third time, they're kind of enjoying it.
That's right. And Dietrich Stoppel is the equivalent of Scarface.
Right. So, you know, I don't have any evidence for my conjectures. It is conjecture. But I will say that one of the things that has happened in the past few years as a result of both p-hacking and questionable research practices and outright fraud is that there have been people who have developed techniques to look at data and sniff out suspicious data to see whether or not it's the kind of data you would actually find in the real world. I think making it part of the culture of science to make your data openly available, to responsibly keep track of the sort of chain of evidence, the data from the time it's collected all the way to the time that it's posted publicly. These are all, I think, the kind of structural things that will make it less so that we have to rely on any individual's moral judgment, because that's always a bit risky, and more on the fact that it would be difficult to get away with this.
That's right. And with regard to p-hacking and other things, I think a cultural change as well, which I think has largely happened, where if you look at one of my papers and you reanalyze the data and you say, no, you did the study wrong, you analyzed it wrong, you don't get to find it, you say you get it. And I say, you're right at that result. I'm glad you caught that. That should be a good thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think to the credit of our field, a lot of people have said about their previous work, I've looked this over and I no longer believe this result. And a lot of people just say that's wonderful. You're acting like a true scientist.
And that can be very difficult when you have built a career on a particular set of hypotheses that you've tested over dozens of papers, yeah, and somebody points out the flaws. It's very easy to get defensive about it. It's very easy to think of your papers and your studies as your child or an extension of you and defend it to the death. But I think if I've contributed in any way that obfuscates the truth, I prefer that to be known. And I prefer to know it. After all, I undertook those studies because I'm curious about that specific question. If it's not true, I would like to know.
Well, maybe you're a better person than me. I do have that attitude. I do want to know the truth. But my first reaction, if somebody says, oh, your study is particularly if they say it rudely or yeah, derisively, your study is nonsense, is to get defensive. Not only do I want to know the truth, I also want to be well-paid and have a job and be well-respected in the field.
Yeah, and there are concerns about your legacy, your contribution. Yeah. I mean, I think that's totally fair. I don't mean to say that I won't get defensive, because I'm sure that I would. You know, you get sometimes requests to share your data.
Yes.
My heart does sink a little bit, because it means that it's somebody who doesn't believe my original finding and wants to catch me in something.
You treat it, and I do too, like an IRS audit. Which is
exactly.
The nice people from the IRS are going to analyze my finances and make sure I did my taxes right. How good it is to get that all nailed down.
That's true. I wouldn't want to have paid the wrong amount of tax.
That's right. What if I pay too little? They're going to correct us all and maybe fine me. So it is difficult, and I think we have to work very hard on working on our attitudes about this. It's been at some level a difficult correction, but it's just been a really wonderful way we're working very hard to clean up our act.
There are all sorts of details that are still being worked out. But if there's one thing I can see in my students is a completely different attitude toward transparency in scientific practice, a different attitude toward things like sharing data.
Absolutely.
Making all of your materials available. And I think, even not feeling too defensive.
So should we shift gears and spend a few minutes talking about a problem in psychology which some people believe to be even worse than the replication crisis?
Yes, the weird problem.
The weird problem. The term was thought up by Joseph Henrich and his colleagues, the term weird, and it's an acronym, meaning Western Educated Industrialized Rich Democracies.
Published originally in your journal.
In my journal, Behavioral and Brain Sciences, I was the editor who handled their paper called The Weirdest People in the World. The idea here is that people in these societies, Canada, United States, New Zealand, Australia, France, are in some ways psychologically different from the rest of the world. That's sort of an empirical claim they make. But whatever you think of that, what's really clear is that they are wildly overrepresented in our psychological science. So one statistic that Henrich and his colleagues say is, I'm going to hear, a randomly selected American undergraduate is more than 4,000 times more likely to be a research participant than a randomly selected person from outside the West. So, you know, what other people have said is we should take our journals, like Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and just change it to Journal of American Personality and Social Psychology, and change the journal Cognitive Development to Cognitive Development Among Highly Educated Undergraduates and the Children of those same families in the West, you know, and Of course, we don't want to do that. We say, no, I'm not studying memory in Americans. I'm studying memory. I'm studying vision. I'm studying stereotyping. I'm studying mental illness. But the critique is, since we almost exclusively study from this narrow subpopulation, we are unequipped to tell whether or not we're getting universals or we're getting cultural particulars.
I have mixed feelings about this critique because on the one hand, I think it is a no-brainer to try to collect data from a diverse set of participants. And it's absolutely true that the field has been built on 20-year-old college sophomores at universities that have a psych department. And surely there are limitations in what you can conclude from studying just those people. So I want to take that seriously, and I believe it to be true. On the other hand, there is a way in which some processes I really do believe to be universal. But I don't think that what you need to do if you want to know whether a visual illusion works is I don't need to study college undergraduates, old people living in assisted living homes, and young Incan children. It seems as if there are some things that we might be able to know a priori are not going to be that changeable across people. Now, of course, Henrik wants to say that some of the things that you thought were universal, here's some evidence that they're not universal. Yeah. But I'm not sure I agree with all of what they say.
I think I agree with you regarding both aspects of your claim. So I also think that a lot of what you find among rich, educated, even undergraduates at universities will also show up everywhere in the world because you're capturing facts about humans. And it's no different than if you were to study aspects of their biology or their genes or their physiology. But having said that, I have to admit it's sort of an empirical claim, and you're not going to know it's right until you look at other populations. So you know, it's very tempting for me to say, and in fact, I do think that the fundamentals of how we perceive the world are just part of the human architecture and don't differ. Henrik and his colleagues will say, no, you know, visual illusions, for instance, work in some cultures and not others. And I think we could have a really vibrant argument of whether that's true. And I actually think that the universal side is more evidence for it. But we won't know for sure until we have a broader sample. And sometimes when you do these broader samples, results are really interesting, supporting both universals and particulars. So studies, for instance, of sex differences in certain aspects of who you find attractive, find universals among every culture ever studied. These striking universals. But at the same time, they also find that cultures differ in certain ways. So I share your sort of priors, your biases about how things are going to work out. But we can know for sure until we do more broader studies.
You're absolutely right. And so maybe the burden is on the researcher who makes a claim about universality, which is not always the case. This is another misunderstanding, but I'll get to that in a second. But if you say we have demonstrated this universal process in the way that humans use stereotypes. The burden is on you to test it in, doesn't mean you have to test it in every population in the world, but maybe one or two other ones could at least falsify that claim. Suppose that I study something that I truly believe is a robust phenomenon across all human beings, the storage capacity of short-term memory. And I find you get, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 words are easily remembered. If I claim that it's universal and I say, well, let me give this a shot. Let me study it in undergraduates in Argentina.
Yeah.
And I fail to find it there. Then boom, now at least you have the ability to, because you can never say this is truly universal in any confident way unless you test it across all people. And nobody's going to test it across all people. But you can at least make some hypotheses about where you ought to find it and where you don't.
That's right. And I think if you test enough people from enough of a range, you could at some point reasonably extrapolate to the rest of the world. So if you tested people from 100 different cultures in 100 different, you know, different countries and get the same result, and then I come up to you and say, well, you haven't tested elderly people in Tucson, Arizona, You can say, well, there's no reason to expect that to be different. That's just basic scientific generalization. If you find that some blood pressure medication lowers people's blood pressure and you test it across 100 diverse populations and it always does that, you could say, oh, it seems to work for humans. It seems to work for people.
To be even more fair to the weird hypotheses, the stuff that I study, I should look more at other people outside of the US, for instance, because when you're studying things like moral judgment or emotion, we have good reason to believe that that might actually differ. And you might wonder whether or not, for instance, the fact that people seem to have strong intuitions, that the intention behind an action matters more than the consequences of that action. It could be that what's happening is I have a failure of imagination to predict that in some cultures, consequences might beat out intentions.
Yeah, that's a great example. And for that kind of example, you probably want to go beyond cross-cultural studies. So there's no law saying that, psychologists are forbidden to look at history. I sometimes find psychologists make claims about universals that are falsified by anybody who would read the Bible or read, or actually to more to the point about non-universals where they say, I've heard psychologists make claims that some of our biases, call them racial biases, are a modern invention that one, could find in the West. And you say, really? Have you read books from like 1,000, from a while ago? No, this stuff's all around. And so there's history. There's looking at development to see how things emerge in kids. I, to some extent, think if you find it in babies, that's a good argument for universality, though I think in some ways there are some exceptions. And then for some of the things, not what you're talking about regarding prejudice, but for some other things, you could look at other creatures, other animals.
Like our friend Laurie Santos's work looking at financial decision-making in capuchins.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So if and again, often these things provide surprising force for people to argue for universals. If somebody says, oh my gosh, that capacity we're interested in seems to be a product of Western culture since 1900, and you find it in dogs, well, you're probably wrong.
That's right.
And I think a lot of the evidence from history, from cross-cultural studies, from development points to universals. But having said that, there have been some surprises. So one surprise, for instance, is that you think of hemispheric differences. Language is typically located in the left part of the brain. Face recognition typically located in the right part of the brain. And there's some evidence that this is not universal, but to some extent influenced by reading. And when you learn to read, it creates what's called a letterbox in the brain. And that it sort of accentuates hemispheric differences. And I don't know if I think that that's right or wrong. I think I need to look closer at that. But it's possible that even things having to do with sort of fundamental neural architecture could be affected by culture in interesting ways.
Maybe here's a way to end a discussion like this. And I'm curious about your thoughts. But I would tell anybody who has gotten this far into listening to this podcast and reading your book and consuming behavioral science in general, that all scientific conclusions are usually tentative.
Yeah.
And what you really want to do is look at an entire body of evidence. You want to educate yourself enough to know when something is clearly wrong with the conclusions of either the researchers or more often the way in which the press release or the press talks about a study. Kind of train yourself to sniff out some of the problems like we've talked about p-hacking or publication bias, selective reporting, all that stuff, and look for multiple studies that would support that conclusion. And I think to end with what we were just talking about, the more evidence that you have that this is true in not just one small sliver of the population, the better you can feel about concluding that it's a universal. So all this is good stuff, I think, as a consumer of science, which we increasingly have to be.
Yeah, I think I'm largely a developmental psychologist, and I've raised two sons. Sometimes people ask me, so how has your understanding of developmental psychology affected how you're a parent? And I mean, one way is I know enough about the field to know that I shouldn't listen to individual studies telling me how to raise my kids.
That's right.
So some way there's a skepticism, but there's also, as you say, there's an optimism. In some areas, we have large bodies of studies painting a really interesting picture of what's going on. And I also think just in general, we have the tools now of better science and, you know, cross-cultural and historical studies and so on to really, really help us learn more.
Absolutely.
There we go. That's an optimistic ending.
That is. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.